Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cersini.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
Dwayne DeFreitas and Christopher Brunor may be joining us a little bit later. Both of them are running a little bit late, but we'll either hear from them tonight or we won't. But in the meantime, we're perfectly capable of running this show on our own, aren't we?
Yes. We've got this covered. We're locked in and ready to blast off at 88 miles per hour.
So this week, the NSA most likely has your address book and contacts. Google's new terms of service put you in their ads. Your PlayStation 4 may be made by unpaid interns. Netflix on your cable box. Former Valve employees launch augmented reality goggles. And a spaceship gets clearance to land in Cupertino. All this and more tonight. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to Geeks of Doom, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And subscribe to us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. Tosin, you've been playing with something over the last week.
Yes, I'm a bit late to the ball game, but I've been recently using an iOS app called Snapchat. So I'm sure you've all heard of Snapchat, right?
The way that I know about Snapchat is that is the notorious app that is used for sexting because it's destructible photo sharing, right? Once you shared a photo with somebody, it goes away forever.
Right, quote unquote destructive. I think people have found ways around it. So if you're listening out there, I wouldn't really utilize Snapchat in terms of a pure disruptive technology. But in terms of why I've been using it is because I have a few friends who are always talking about Snapchat or utilizing it in some shape or form, and I've, similar to Andy, I'd only heard of it in more negative connotations or more
prurient.
Yes, that is exactly. But I decided that, you know what, as someone who is a technological lover, I should make sure I understand everything and give it a shot. So I installed Snapchat and have been using it with a few friends of late, and it's actually been quite an interesting and a unique experience. When really just trying to describe it, the way I feel that it really comes off is more like a vignette or even a haiku, because given that you are sending something that only lasts, you know, 3 to potentially 10 seconds, you need to be able to be very creative in what you are displaying, and you're also limited in the number of characters that you can use within a actual photo. So if I wanted to add basically a subtitle, I could add a line which is less characters than you have with Twitter. So it's really, to me, it actually is kind of quite the artistic form in what you choose to show. Mm-hmm. And it's really, it's to a certain extent, it's semi-pure because it just only exists for a very brief moment. I think one of the issues that I thought I was going to have with it is I have so many other means of sharing and distributing content with friends, be it Twitter, be it Facebook, you know, even email, right? Because I'm not really using this service for things that I wouldn't share in public or, you know, things that I only want sent for a brief period of time. But it's just really, I don't know, there's some sort of unique essence about it. So, for example, let me try and think of an example of a few things I've sent out.
Uh-huh.
One was I was playing a few. You can do video as well too. You can do a very short video.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I was playing a few chords on a guitar, and I was like, let me record this from kind of an angle that shows sort of the inner workings of the guitar and the strings vibrating. And that was pretty unique. Or yesterday I was at the office very late, and I needed to send a quick note to someone, and so I took a photo of something random that we had in the office. I think it was it may have been the sriracha bear that you see from the oatmeal, which we have as like a poster, and it was like a title that said another late night at the office, and just it's literally really just like a haiku into the essence of what you're doing at that moment or what your life is.
But these are all things that you don't expect to keep at all because of the nature of Snapchat's destructible sharing.
As the person who creates the content, you can now actually save it if you choose to save it initially. But for the most part, it's really, you know, these are things that I wouldn't naturally just take a photo of and save. You know, I don't really need a photo of the sriracha bear on my phone or a photo of, you know, my friend's expression after the Red Sox won a baseball game. I don't necessarily need to have that for a lifetime, but it's kind of cool to see it from the moment. And also know that whenever I go to click on this, I start the timer of this fleeting moment. So I have to be prepared that, you know, I'm only going to have this for a limited time. I can't just come back to this. Which is kind of elegant and kind of unique. I don't know if it really has a long impact in terms of business model or anything to that nature. But it's actually sort of like an art form, you know.
We're joined by Duane DeFreitas. How are you,
hey,
Duane?
Guys. What's going on?
We're talking Duane. About Snapchat, which is Toasted's discovery, his discovery for this week.
Yeah, I've been enlightened about Snapchat because I've started using it.
Oh, there you go. It's like, it's great. I started heavily using Indiegogo this week.
Tell us more.
I mean, not much to tell. It's a lot like Kickstarter. Doesn't have an app, which is not one I could find that's useful.
Is Indiegogo, now, do they fund whether or not the project launches or not? From what I understand, they're different in Kickstarter in the respect where, you know, if a Kickstarter project doesn't launch, they don't cash your money. But I think with Indiegogo, they do regardless, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the idea is that when they hit the donation threshold, they will be funded. They will get all the money. That kind of thing. And you're set. I'm not really sure of the difference. I haven't explored it that way. But I find that the projects are a little different. The projects are a little bit more, they seem to be slightly more focused on Indiegogo. They just want really specific things. But the thing that got me excited about it was I was looking around and I found some things. One of the things I found that I liked is there's a water bottle that is basically Bluetooth enabled and has sensors in it to tell you how much water you've been drinking. And sure, this water bottle, yeah, it's like $54 or something, $59. You can buy them in sets of 2. You can buy them in sets of 10, whatever. But the big thing is it's like Fitbit for water. So if you like that type of, you know, it vibrates, it does all this stuff, has lights to remind you, hey, you're not drinking, all that crap. And that's interesting. The funny thing about it, though, was I was watching the video, and I'm not sure whether or not it was real. The video has the Helvetica script and white background. And the various like product engineers and other people talking about the device as if it's an Apple video.
That's funny.
And it was really unclear whether or not their exuberance was genuine or farcical. So it was definitely worth. It's definitely like a ride. But that's like the geekiness of it all. Like, you know, that's the thing.
Is it the blue Fit bottle?
The blue Fit bottle.
Okay, I'm looking at that campaign right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you want to play the video and have people hear sort of.
I'll put the link in the show notes for sure.
There you go. And what's interesting about it is that, like, I look at a product like that, and, you know, I'm very product centric, and I'm thinking, if they do pull it off, if it does work, then a company like Fitbit or Nike needs to chase them down. Because one of the you look at the big pain points of the software aspects of these of those devices, and it's the inputting, right? The inputting of how much water did you drink today? What did you eat today? Logging that stuff. That's painful. If your water bottle does it for you, if your water bottle tells the system what you've been up to through your phone, then that's a big piece solved in terms of the puzzle of how someone's doing. Likewise with the food thing, you know, I think it's like one of the weight loss programs is a great QR reader in it. It's basically a barcode scanner. So if you're eating your lean cuisine, you can just scan the barcode of the package box. And that's another thing that those guys need as well, especially Fitbit, because logging your food on Fitbit is painful. And they should have a QR scanner in there just to, like, take that load off of you. Because you do that. You would say, oh, I'm about to eat this thing, put it in the microwave, whatever. Blip. All right. That's a data point taken care of.
So, yeah, I've seen readers, diet readers that have that barcode reader and can, you know, across –
Yeah, Lose It does that.
I think Weight Watchers, the official Weight Watchers app, does that as well.
Right. And I mean, for them, it's basically like they've got their own food that they put out.
Yeah.
But Lose It does it. It has like a database across multiple different types of food. And that's what's sweet about it. I look at that kind of stuff and, you know, I'm that's where I spend my. The time that I guess would be spent on Facebook, I'm spending on things like Indiegogo and Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, usually I will really if I see something really appealing in on Kickstarter, I'll make the leap and invest. And in fact, one of the stories we're going to be talking about this week is kind of sad for me because I don't have the funds to invest in it, and I really want to. So it's kind of I died a little on the inside. Knowing that I'm not going to be a part of this one.
Yeah, it's always hard. I don't know if I'm going to spend money on Bluefit. I know I have a few days, and I know I always wait to the last minute to do it, but it sounds like it's a great product. It's just that, do I need an electric water bottle?
Right, right.
Do I need a $54 electric water right. bottle? I did spend $30 on a tea mug. It's a mug that, you know, it's got 7 hours of this kind of hot insulation and 9 hours of cold insulation or whatever. You know, it doesn't matter where you put your mouth. You don't. There's no like specific spout. It's designed so that the liquid goes anywhere you need it to. It fits in your car cup holder. All those things. And I was like, yeah, it's exactly what I need. But was it?
As comical as the concept of electric water bottle sounds, it is a step forward towards that concept of the Internet of Things.
Well, it's the quantify itself to start. Like, I know the big thing is I know what's up. The secondary thing is that, yeah, I like the idea that everything I have is Wi-Fi'd, except for the possible cancer problem later. But I like the general idea that everything I have connects to something so that we all know what it means. You know, like I put the big thing that I did this week was I put a I have an old Fitbit Ultra. My friend gave it to me for my birthday last year, but I've since been able to get a Fitbit One. The alarm is really helpful for me. And I have two kittens. They're about 5 months old, and one of them is wearing the old Fitbit Ultra day by day.
What?
She's got an account. She gets about 7,000 steps in a day.
That's what I was going to ask, is what kind of data do you get off of that Fitbit?
Yeah, so, I mean, like, you just got to, like, I just want to do everything like that, you know?
It's hilarious.
I'm looking online for a cheap Fitbit Ultra for the other cat. Just so
you know, that's not a bad idea. I don't want to spill any potentially lucrative ideas here on our broadcast, but a collar, a Fitbit-like collar for dogs and cats. So you can measure your dog or cat's, you know, quantify their selves. That would be an interesting idea.
So the whole reason why I thought of it was that, you know, you have a couple cats, you look at their day by day, you have them up there, and you can check into their stats, make them your friends on something like Fitbit. That's a life hack that quickly and easily lets you know, hey, today was really lethargic. I wonder if that kitten's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's an early warning. You don't have to wonder or not. If it's lethargic based on what you see, you get real data throughout the day. And
I thought about getting the Fitbit Flex, the band, and putting that around their neck, but they're going to grow out of that. But for the normal collar, it's the Fitbit Ultra fits perfectly. I'll send a picture that I posted on Instagram. We'll put it on the show notes, and you just be able to see that, you know, this kitty has, you know, that kind of functionality, and she's totally fine with it. It falls right down the nape of her neck in the middle, and she's totally okay. She doesn't experience any, you know, any trouble doing anything.
That's hilarious.
She's eating, she's drinking. Yeah. I also found I also invested in this bin. It's a feeder, an automatic feeder, but it's also Wi-Fi capable. And what it does is it has a scale on it. And so when the food is low, it'll tell you on your phone, and you can decide whether or not you feel like the cat should eat more or whatever, you know?
So I'm talking about, it's all going to be connected.
Yeah. And that helps. It's going to help the season when I'm snowboarding and I'm sleeping over on Saturday night somewhere in the mountains and my cats are, you know, not in the mountains. And I'm like, all right, they're on a timer obviously, but let's just see what kind of food intake they've had.
Yep.
You know?
All right, let's get into some headlines here. According to the Washington Post, the National Security Agency is harvesting hundreds of millions of contact lists from personal email and instant messaging accounts all around the world, many of them belonging to Americans, according to senior intelligence officials and top secret documents provided by Edward Snowden. It's Snowden Watch again on the drill down. The collection program intercepts email addresses, books, and buddy lists from IM services as they move across global data links. Online services often transmit those contacts when a user logs on. Rather than targeting individual users, the NSA has been gathering contact lists in large numbers that amount to a sizable fraction of the world's email and instant messaging accounts.
They're going
to
catalog every single connected person in the world. It's brilliant. Like, you think about it. It's absolutely brilliant, except for the fact that it's absolutely nefarious.
Yes.
But if you could, there's a LinkedIn app, if you go to LinkedIn's beta app space, where you can look at everyone you're connected to, and it's in a big web that's meshed based on how they're connected to one another. If you have the resources of the NSA and you can link everyone who's connected to anybody, then suddenly you have a map of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon for the world.
Yep.
And over 7 billion people... Something that, like, you know, between 2 and 5 billion of those people are connected, and suddenly you have an idea of the organizational relationships between people, and you can do interesting things. Now, if this was the 60s, I'd be really worried because you've got the Dulles brothers fucking with, you know, Iran and Guatemala and shit like that, using it to destabilize places that were not friendly to America, but that they didn't like, basically. But it's unclear what the NSA wants to do.
Well, their rationalization is they're using that data to search for hidden connections.
Yeah, between baddies. Yeah, I get it. But still, it's unclear what they really want to do with it.
Yeah. The like, stats
would,
on this.
I would say that. Wouldn't you say that if that's what you had lying around? Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, of course. Well, that's their overall sort of their umbrella rationalization for all of this data collection. The stats on this are fairly amazing. During a single day last year, the NSA Special Source Operations Branch collected 444,000 email address books from Yahoo, 105,000 from Hotmail, 82,000 from Facebook, 33,000 from Gmail, and 22,000 from other providers.
That's it?
Yeah. Well, but the figures, if you calculate those on a daily basis, that corresponds to a rate of more than 250 million a year.
Oh, okay. That sounds better.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. So there you
and
go.
The best part is, you know, like, unlike LavaBit, these guys didn't say anything. So that's, you know what I mean? Like, who's got your data?
Yeah.
Like, LavaBit saying, hey, I'm shutting down. Hey, like, there's a loophole in this thing. I'm going to talk about it. They wanted all your shit. And I was like, no. Google, Yahoo, these guys are like, well, you know, I got shareholders. You know,
did they know about this is the question. Did they know specifically about the address book collection?
I think that when we look at like LavaBit and the fact that you look at the privacy policies of these companies that say basically they will share your information if they're court ordered to. Yeah. There's no question. There's absolutely no question. You know, like, with the amount of security these guys have, NSA wouldn't, you know, why waste the time hacking in if you can get a FISA-based court order to say, just give it to me. You know, it's just pure economics. Like, I can get a judge who's friendly to me to give me the warrant, so I'm going to do that. Why would I spend time, energy, and resources to sneak it around? And that's really what we have in front of us. It's a mess.
It's a mess. It's a mess.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Moving on. Short and sweet. Twitter has filed an amendment to the S-1 filing with the Securities Exchange Commission, confirming that it's going to file its initial IPO on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol of TWTR. So that's going to be Twitter's stock symbol, TWTR.
Yeah. Now, did you hear the story of how a company who had a similar who used to have a similar symbol? Was it Twitter? Twitter?
I can't remember what the symbol is, but it was. Yeah, I do. I did hear about this. They got a stock a jump in their stocks because people had assumed that that was Twitter's upcoming stocks symbol.
Yeah, this was after they already had claimed bankruptcy a while back. So a lot of people were kind of just idly tossing their money into other services.
What's interesting about this whole thing is that we think of the social media landscape as being dominated by Facebook and Twitter. But to give you some like ideas of order of magnitude, how Facebook dwarfs Twitter, Twitter is showing up at $1 billion and Facebook showed up at $100 billion. Right?
Yeah.
That should give anyone who's following this stuff a significant amount of pause. Facebook showed up at $100 billion and it dramatically fell. Twitter's taking a decidedly more conservative approach. With you know, they have about a fifth of the active users that Facebook has, 200 million versus Facebook's 1 billion. Let's not even call them active. Let's just call them straight users. So there's something there about the conservative nature of this IPO.
Yeah, I mean, it will be really interesting to see. You know, we'll see how people when they are public, what people do with the stock in terms of. You know, are people just gonna jump on it for the name brand, or you know,
I think
realistically?
People learned some lessons.
Yeah, have they learned a lesson? Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm curious about. You know,
I'm gonna say that I agree with you, Dwayne. I think people have learned their lesson from the whole Facebook launch.
Yeah, I think they've learned the lesson, but I also think it's just important to realize how much different this IPO is. It's not the typical. It's not what Facebook attempted to do. And it's interesting because you look at Facebook, and a lot of people made a lot of money off of that.
Yeah.
And we'll see who's really going to take home the bank from the Twitter IPO. I'm kind of excited to see it unfold.
Moving on, Google TV is dead. Long live Android TV. 3 years after launching the first generation of Google TV devices, Google is looking to rid itself of the brand and realign its smart TV platform's efforts more closely with Android. It's a part.
Did we not predict this last week with Samsung?
Yeah, I mean,
brand perspective, we basically said Samsung's not calling it smart TV. Call it Galaxy TV. Google like listened to our podcast clearly and said we're not going to call it Google TV. We're going to call it Android TV to go along with our operating system.
Yeah. I mean, Google TV had a lot of had a lot of hurdles in its path. Least of which is that the content providers didn't want to get on board.
Well, it was so much more ambitious in its scope. The Apple TV is, you know, just like true to Apple, a tied down device that integrates great with Apple products, but is a standalone device for the most part. They use their market power to get others to hop in and join them. Whereas Google was saying, hey, look, cable. Hey, look, you 95 different companies that are going to make, you know, that make content and that distribute cable services or whatever. We want to integrate with all of you. Yep. And that is a hard, unless you, like, you can have an army of biz dev people. But one of the things that biz dev is founded on is the idea of exclusivity and access. So HBO can say, hey, Apple, we really want to be on your product. And Apple will be like, yeah, let's do this. And Disney can do the same. But when you're trying to get HBO, A&E, Disney, and all these other guys, they're all going to say, well, I want to distinguish myself. I want to be different. Well, what are you giving them? And then that becomes messy. Yeah. I think Google was crazy ambitious, and it was an idea to change every TV.
Yeah.
Not just kind of get a product that helps your TV. It lacked the simplification.
Well, I think they also didn't really push it as much to the consumer, because Google TV, from what I've seen from friends who have it, is pretty outstanding.
It is.
When you have the cable, but it's not a cable cord cutting thing, is the first thing. It doesn't cut the cord. And it's outstanding when you have a service like Dish, which has decided to integrate with it because it was a downtrodden player in that market.
But or even across devices too. So, just even being able to use your phone as the remote, being able to turn on and off your TV based off of, interactions on your phone. I have a few friends who, because of the Google TV integration, have no clue where their TV remotes are.
Yeah. See, and that's interesting, because I'm a person who, for a while, attempted to use my phone as a remote. It was the worst experience with a remote that I've ever had. I went out and spent $200 on a Logitech Harmony, because a flat surface with no tactile feeling as the remote control, and that glows when the lights are off and you're watching your favorite movie, that to me was not the experience that I was looking for in the no keyboard HTPC kind of world.
Yeah, I think it's also further with the other aspects of the integration. So, it's not only just the control there, but it's the ability to push, the ability to do a lot of really unique things. And I think we see some of that from, Google's latest device, the Chromecast, right?
The Chromecast gave the concept of Google TV a new lease on life. I didn't even know though.
I think the Chromecast showed them that they need to get rid of the Google TV brand. I've got a $35 device that can handle all these things, and I'm just having people spend $300 on the Chromecast. I'm having people, on the Google TV. Uh-huh. I'm having people, go out and try to get like these Sony TVs with 60 hertz refresh rates and so on. Even though I've got this $35 device that anyone can connect to their TV, I think Google learned that having a $100 sub $100 device that allows you to use your phone directly, use your phone as the powerhouse and all that stuff,
it caused them to rethink the whole paradigm.
Right. And it also goes to show the power of having the Chrome OS, the Chrome name, the Chrome brand, the Chrome experience distinct from the Android experience. It if you look at the world of iOS versus Android, there's no doubt that Android dragged iOS kicking and screaming into a featureful, modern, both UI, now that we have iOS 7, and an operating system.
Yeah.
Like the ease of getting to Bluetooth, the ease of all these other things like that. They all happened, copy and paste, whatever. It all happened because Android was, just running ahead, trying to put the kitchen sink and everything. I bother to chase it. You look at what Chrome and Android are doing, they are riffing off of one another. So it's like they've created competition for themselves, and that is, driving their stuff to be a little better than it would otherwise be. So that's interesting.
I didn't realize this until I did the research for this this article, but the Chromecast is the number one selling electronics device on Amazon, outselling even Amazon's new Kindle models, as well as Apple TV and Roku.
Yeah, so that's huge, because long has the Kindle been Amazon's, hey, this is our top electronic selling device. I'm not going to give you numbers, but it's our top thing. Google comes out with the Chromecast, and this interesting frenemy situation between Amazon and Google grows even more interesting. Amazon, I'm going to use your technology, but at the same time, I'm going to fork it so that it's not exactly the stuff that you've come out with. Meanwhile, Google's like, okay, I'm going to put some stuff on your store, and it's going to like blow away the sales of everything. And the Chromecast is a phenomenal value at $35.
Yeah, and people realize that. So, hey, make good products. And,
right. And in the wake of Apple TV, Apple TV was an expensive niche device, $200, $300 for some crazy thing when it first came out that had 720p value, small hard drive, all that stuff. When they rethought Apple TV and it was basically an iOS device, it really showed that, wow, this is disruptive. You get this whole thing for $100 from a company like Apple. Then when Chromecast comes out and it's a third of that price and it allows you to use your phone, which is the thing that most people have, a mobile operating system attached to your television set, you know, it's a no-brainer, especially if you have an Android and you have got that kind of penetration. The weirdest thing, though, for me with Chromecast was the fact that my Chrome device, my original Chrome laptop, did not work with it out of the box.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Google, they're expanding the use of shared endorsements in ads starting November 11th. That's where people in images and the things they like and comment on and rate and review through the Google Plus social network can be used in their endorsements. For the last couple of years, Google has allowed advertisers to show people if people like their content within ads. But beginning November 11th, its terms are changing to allow for more than plus one likes to be shown in ads. Now, if you make a review about something or leave a comment or follow a particular brand, that and other social actions may appear in the ads of Google or as shown through its display network along with your image. So that's a change in Google's terms of service that you are automatically opted in on, that you could be your image, your likeness could be used to in conjunction with advertisements on Google.
See, my real question is, is it only positive advertisements, or will it also involve negative feedback that you may have had on
I don't think you have
it
a choice.
It never involves negative feedback. That's why you can't dislike something on Facebook.
Exactly.
It's the antithesis of marketers' needs to show negative feedback. You only want to show that there are advocates of your brand among those people that possible prospective consumers would have respect for or find influential. So you'd never, so you might. There's just
then,
no mechanism.
And
are no
we losing the truthfulness of what it actually is?
No,
or about, I guess ultimately, are ads even truth?
Ads are always true, but by law they're true. But I think what you're thinking about is the problem is promotion, right? So, like, what you're doing is you're using individuals to promote your product. You're not using individuals to dissent against your product. You know, they're not giving substantive feedback that's becoming part of this. They're just plus one-ing it.
Right.
And that's why it's powerful and useful. Because they're not, it's kind of like giving everything an Amazon star rating, except there's only one star rating, and that's positive. Just like Facebook likes. You've never been able to dislike anything. In fact, when they made a dislike app, a third party, Facebook got rid of it.
Right.
You know? Because the idea is promotion. Get people to promote. Get people to hand raise. Get people to advocate. And frankly, all things being equal, if people are not endorsing your product, you can tell your product has a problem. Mm-hmm. So every product is endorsable equally, and people can endorse your product, and your product is not being endorsed, and those three conditions are met, then clearly other people are doing better than you.
Well, if you if for some reason you don't want to be part of this shared endorsement push on by Google, there is a page located on the Google Plus website where you can opt out of appearing in ads now and in the future, and we're going to link to that page in the show notes so that you can find it easily.
Now, are you guys going to opt out?
I already have.
I will.
Yeah.
It's not within my interests, but, you know. It's like, you know how, like, in iOS, Apple says most people don't have a passcode? Most people aren't going to opt out. Just like most people did not opt out of AT&T saying that they're going to sell your location information to the highest bidder. You know? People aren't – they're not reading the fine print.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not hugely offended by it, but I just opted out. Anyway, just to be on the safe side.
It's the default, yeah. It's also, I don't know about you guys. When you live with people or when you're hanging out with children or whatever, you lend them your device, suddenly you're on Amazon or Netflix the next day and you're getting recommended for things that you have no interest in because someone borrowed your device to look something up or check something out or whatever. Who knows what, you know, who knows what people are going to endorse on your behalf?
Right.
You know, visually. So, I don't know.
You want to control your message.
Exactly. It's your personal message. Yeah. And, you know, I just opened up Netflix too many times to Dora the Explorer because a little cousin has been like, I want to borrow your phone now. I happen to know your code. I saw you put it in. I'm going to have fun with it.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook that I want to recommend this week is called A Homeland Phantom Pain, by Glenn Gehrs and narrated by Damian Lewis. Dwayne, do you watch Homeland, the Showtime series?
I've only seen season one. I was pretty impressed.
Yeah. So basically, for people who don't know, aren't familiar with it, Homeland is the story of Marine Nicholas Brody, who is hailed as a hero after he returns home from 8 years of captivity in Iraq, and the FBI intelligence officer, Kerry Matheson, who is the only one who suspects that he may have been turned. So in this short story on Audible, Emmy Award winner Damian Lewis, who stars as U.S. Marine Sergeant Nicholas Brody, narrates this original Homeland story of Brody's journey into exile, which it picks up at the end of season two. It's basically what happened to Nicholas Brody between season two and the beginning of season three. And this is an unusual offering for Audible in that even if you are an Audible subscriber, this isn't going to cost you any of your credits. It's absolutely free. So whether you are an Audible subscriber or not, through this offer, it's free. And even if you are an Audible subscriber, it's free. Anyway, it's like,
so you're saying people should get another book for free and then go get this book?
Yes. Yeah. But this is the one yes. So,
but it is a nice crossover in media, and it goes to like a lot of what we've spoken about, you know, regarding this idea that you use traditional media like TV and then you tie it into digital media.
Absolutely.
You know, extended content, downloadable content, exclusive content. They can't get anywhere else to tie into the story. They can't mantra of it's just story.
Yeah, exactly. So to download that free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles. And going to that site helps us out on the show, so please do that. So we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Chinese laborers make notoriously low wages, but the workers who made your PlayStation 4 may not have been paid at all. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. Quartz.com reports that Foxconn has a deal with China's Xi'an Institute of Technology to expose more than 1,000 of them to the educational experience of working on an assembly line for Sony's forthcoming PlayStation 4. Engineering students from the XIT were told that if they didn't participate in the internship program, they wouldn't receive 6 course credits effectively making it impossible for them to graduate. The students were assigned to night shifts and overtime in violation of the company's policy. Immediate actions have been taken to bring that campus in full compliance with our code and policies, Foxconn said in a statement, including reinforcing the policies of no overtime and no night shifts for student interns, even though such work is voluntary. Foxconn maintains similar internship programs at many locations in China, they added, to provide students with the opportunity to gain practical work experience and on-the-job training that will support their efforts to find employment following their graduation. Sony did not immediately respond to a request for comment. So that's kind of slimy, putting them on the assembly line. I can understand.
It's once again the Japanese are putting the Chinese down, just like 1939, Japanese attacking the Chinese. I see what's going on.
Oddly enough, I've heard similar stories from about in the U.S. from Amazon about interns working on the stock picking floor. I think there was an article in Wired. I think those were paid interns in any case. Hopefully they lock that up and shut that down immediately. I'd hate to think of them of people not basically it's, you know, a big corporation leveraging free labor through internships. Happens here all the time, but not necessarily on assembly.
On an assembly line, yeah. And we don't look at, culturally, we look at an assembly line as not a professionally exciting job.
Right.
I don't know how China looks at it. I mean, China's clearly got to view assembly line work as, you know, it may not be the most glamorous, but not unlike Detroit in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, it's probably considered, you know, what's good for Foxconn is good for China kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
With people with stable jobs, making significant wages for that economy. So I don't know how it's viewed. It's that our culture has changed to a more service-oriented economy. Yeah, we want these goods. And it's an interesting challenge, you know, the poverty and inequality that is associated with creating these devices at the kinds of margins that allow Sony to compete with the Xbox One.
I would pay a little extra to know that my PlayStation 4 was
slavery offsets.
Yes.
PlayStation 4.
Wow.
Has it really come to that?
I mean, maybe there's one that's made out of like PVC free plastic. It's got green offsets, slavery offsets. Maybe you can get a couple of badges on your device.
There you go.
You know, when you get a device and it's got that logo soup? It's like, oh, HDMI, yeah. Bluetooth, yeah. Everything yeah. under the sun. It's going to be like, you know, non-intern made. Yeah, non-intern made, PVC free, you know, Energy Star, all that stuff. Yeah. Your PlayStation 4. I do like the name of the PlayStation 4, I'm not going to lie.
Mm-hmm.
I think Microsoft has confused me with the names in ways that I'm not happy with.
It's like we're back to one with Microsoft.
I know. The Xbox One, you know, what are we supposed to call the thing that came out in like 2002 other than the original Xbox?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's very annoying. I get Xbox One, but the whole purpose of the term Xbox was to be like, it's one box that's like an X because it does all this other stuff.
Okay, moving on here. Netflix is in talks with several U.S. pay TV providers, including Comcast, to make its service available as an app on their set-top boxes. A deal would mark the online video service's first such tie-up with a U.S. cable provider and would come after a similar agreement it recently announced with Virgin Media. So far, internet providers Comcast, Time Warner, AT&T, and Verizon have declined to use the technology, concerned that such an arrangement could lead other online services to ask for special treatment. For years, several U.S. pay TV providers have been fearful of a link-up with Netflix, worrying the online TV service could lure eyeballs away from their own video services. But some cable operators have warmed to the idea, in part because of improved set-top box technology, and because they believe that Netflix users are more likely to buy more expensive, faster broadband connections. A concern for at least one operator is that Netflix could eventually use the app as a Trojan horse to sell pay-per-view movies or other services that compete directly with the cable operators' video offerings. And that's the first thing that I thought of when I saw this article, is that I couldn't believe that somebody was actually doing it, because it seems like such an obvious competition for their own services. Like, why would
can't beat them, join them. Yeah. And on some level, it's kind of like, hey, what if you could white label Netflix?
But what if you can beat them?
Well, maybe. I think that everything's shown that Netflix is the price that they're getting for their content is disrupting cable networks in a way that doesn't work for cable networks. I mean, there is a new challenge against network neutrality. And if that comes through, then you know Netflix will be SOL. But Netflix is they're being consistent. They've had a stalwart approach to getting onto as many devices as possible.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're on virtually every connected device you can think of, except for my Fitbit scale. So I'm thinking that as they look at set-top boxes, or they look at the Xbox One, which is in many ways trying to be the cable set-top box, the cable-friendly set-top box, or even thinking about Google and their set-top box, which tied into cable and did Netflix. They're like, hey, let's explore what's possible here. Now, if you're Comcast and you can offshoot all your video on demand work to Netflix, that does two things. One, you get to save a lot of resources white labeling Netflix's stuff with the relevant content. Maybe put some exclusive content for those networks that you have that other networks, other cable providers don't have. And two, Netflix doesn't ever have to worry about net neutrality.
Yes. It seems so much so, though, like these cable companies are in exchange for the appeal of having Netflix on their system and drawing people in that way, they may be indirectly signing their own death warrant as an industry.
Well, maybe. I mean, they've got to have value added services in addition to the advertising that they gain money off of. It's been shown up so far. Even HBO Go is like, hey, we don't care if you share a login, they said on the New York Times, because they need to show that people are using it so they can gain more leverage against the cable companies in order to do an a la carte thing. And with the a la carte thing, you know, the cable companies are in a strange position, but for the most part, they get, you know, the producers, the A&Es and the other guys, they get possibly more money with the a la carte thing. There's going to be more churn with their consumers.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now, HBO's maybe, you know, it costs, I don't know, maybe $10, $12 to get HBO on the Comcast out here. So they're maybe getting $8 or $9 of those dollars. If those providers are willing to have their own apps, you know, an A&E app instead of the Netflix app, whatever, then they're standing to make more money. I think the cable guys have to think critically about how they want to add value and how they want to deal with the onslaught of video on demand services, and whether or not, you know, Netflix is the thing that's going to draw people to them or not. I mean, Dish has embraced this stuff for a long time. You know, they bought Blockbuster.
Yeah.
They've got the Sling Box. So Netflix showing up on the doorstep of the guys who aren't Dish and saying, hey, what do you want to do? That doesn't seem to me like a totally, you know, out of this world thing.
Yeah, I mean, they can also do more bargaining than other companies can against these networks. So, you know, it makes sense to at least see what's available, see what's potentially doable.
And they've got Emmys now.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, really.
They're like, we're part of your ecosystem. We have Emmys.
Yeah, it's hard to deny Netflix's position in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to deny.
All right.
And you watch Scandal and you're like, oh shit, TV's awesome.
Moving on here, Polygon.com reports that press, professionals, and fans attending New York's Comic-Con this year discovered that their Twitter accounts were automatically sending out messages praising the show. The pre-written tweets, more than 500 of them, were sent out on accounts shortly after the doors opened. They included the phrases, so much pop culture to digest, can't handle the awesome, hashtag NYCC. So much to see, so much to do. NYCC 2013, I love you. The tweets always included the NYCC hashtag and a link to the show's Facebook page. Convention attendees apparently authorized access to their Twitter account when activating their RFID-enabled convention badges, but likely didn't realize they were approving ghost-written ads to be sent in their name. Kind of a slimy tactic on the New York Comic Con's part.
That's your word for the night, slimy.
Yeah,
slimy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of
slimy going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
we call
interesting.
It viral.
I guess matter of perspective.
It's interesting because, you know, of course they asked for what's your Twitter handle and all that sorts of information, yeah. but they just never were forward or forefront with users.
Forthright?
Yeah, forthright, exactly, with users or sort of consumers, customers, that they were going to go ahead and do this.
How are they actually sending tweets as the users? That's the question I have. I didn't
right,
because
really they had to, during the sign-up process, you had one of the fields there was entering in your Twitter information. But
did
because
you sign
they were doing,
in through Twitter? Is that their
yeah.
Twitter app allowed them to make posts for you?
I'm not sure
that's
exactly
the
what the sign-in process, but in some shape or form, you actually authorized it without really thinking twice.
That's the only way to really do it. Like, have a Twitter app, and this app, you know, you've seen on Facebook, this app is authorized to make posts on your behalf.
Yep.
Right.
Hey, I mean...
So I think it was one of those things where they're like, people will notice, but they didn't really... They didn't call it out, and many people don't read. So, you know,
well,
it just
like
happened
to... It's a big cultural taboo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is kind of, you know, this is very similar to the Google news, right?
Except
Google is being a little bit more forthright about, hey, we're going to make this change.
Google's never really gotten social media the way Comic-Con has, right? Like, Comic-Con is largely promoted through social media. Google Plus is Google's sort of, it's this or the highway attempt at social media after the failures of Buzz and Wave and some other things. So when Google makes a mistake, you're kind of like, okay, well, it's Google on social. Just like Apple doesn't really get social. But Comic-Con, they you know, like Nathan Fillion made Comic-Con social, you know, over the last like decade.
Yeah.
So the fact that they'd allow some, you know, marketing group to hop in there and get a developer that actually did this and not understand that this would become a backlash.
Right. Right.
With this audience, this complete geekster audience.
Yeah. These are
that
people
is all
who...
about their personal messages.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing. It's a weird cultural faux pas where you can see why Google would be like, oh, we're gonna do this in the name of advertising. We're an advertising company. We're out there. We're experimenting with social, and you can't escape us. You can escape Comic-Con. You can say, I'm not going back.
Yeah, these
you
are people like Comic-Con attendees are people who normally promote themselves, who are normally fairly savvy with social media, and they normally would promote something like this event that they're especially a Comic-Con event.
They would promote Comic-Con. Comic-Con had a good magnetic message where the content was tied to advertising, but they want to be the ones to promote it. They want to be the advocates. When Comic-Con steals that from them, that choice. Hides it from them and it kind of, insidiously like drops their message behind those profiles. They're stealing their clout. And let's face it, Comic-Con guys, I have it on great authority that San Diego Comic-Con is attended by the king of all social media. And with the amount of followers that those people have, they're getting great access to it. Now, the problem is it's an awareness move, right? They're not really getting a lot out of it in terms of what's trackable. The people who've paid for Comic-Con are already at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
So what are they getting out of it? It's just, it doesn't seem like it's a lot.
That's a good question.
From just a marketing point of view in terms of like what metric you're really getting out of it, how you're tracking it, and what you're getting out of it. So
seems
it's
like
just a strange situation.
Diminishing returns. Yeah. Diminishing returns in exchange for the amount of promotion that they get out of that. Although they got a lot of promotion from this stunt, not necessarily good promotion, but there you go. So moving on to our last headline here, former Valve employees Jerry Ellsworth and Rick Johnson this week launched a Kickstarter to raise $400,000 for their projected augmented reality glasses that display interactive 3D images right in front of you. The Castar specs are unlike wearable virtual reality headsets like Oculus Rift, which can only project images into your eye instead of the other way around. In a nutshell, these glasses, which weigh less than 100 grams, have two tiny projectors that display 3D images onto retro-reflective material. Those images bounce back to your eyes, producing an interactive scene in front of you. The Castar glasses, the surface is a special material called retro-reflective, which is designed to bounce light almost directly back to the eyes with very little scatter. So it creates beautiful, striking image projections. And actually, in fact, the Castar, it also can do, it's a 3-in-1 device, and it can also do VR, like Oculus Rift. There's three different modes. There's the projection, the mode where it projects onto this retro-reflective material. There's a mode where you clip on a pair of glasses, and the glasses are, see-through, but they project onto the glasses, so you get this sort of real HUD. World, yes, like an augmented reality, but right in front of you, without having to hold anything else up in front of you. And then the glasses also have this fully reflective mode, so it does become like VR, a VR headset. The story behind this one is really interesting. For nearly a year, Ellsworth and Johnson had been working hard on this project at Valve, but Valve didn't quite see how it fit with the type of games that they do, according to Ellsworth. Even though several Valve employees came into their offices and spent hours into the night playing with the glasses, the idea never sunk in with the Valve execs. Soon, Ellsworth and Johnson were sent packing this past February when Valve fired 25 people in a somewhat surprising and out-of-character move. Hours after learning she was fired, Ellsworth met with Valve CEO Gabe Newell and asked if he would let her and Johnson continue working on the glasses outside of Valve. Ellsworth said that Gabe turned to the lawyer in the room and he said, "Let them have it." And she was like, "Oh, okay."
Well, I mean, Valve is known for wanting to expand the tech horizon.
Yeah.
They're refocusing on the Steam Box, whatever. But why do what every other tech company does and kill awesome stuff in development?
Yeah.
Courier.
Yeah.
There's no reason why the Courier couldn't have survived that designer's.
You're still sore about the Courier.
Oh God! I mean, the Courier wasn't made, but the Windows tablet was. Like, come on, that's not okay.
We're going on 3 weeks, I think, that you've mentioned the Courier in one form or another. It's the old wounds. The old wounds hurt.
They ache when the weather changes.
What I'm surprised about this is that Valve, I feel like it was really short-sighted. I'm glad that they were able to form their own company, Technical Illusions, and kickstart this off on their own. And by the way, they've made their funding like 2 days into their.
Did you get into this?
This is the one that I told you that I wish I could.
I know, but what's the cost? What's the cost of the
Well,
device?
In order to get to fund it at the level that will get you a pair of these glasses, the starter package is $189. I think what I really want is the $285 level, which gives you the Castar glasses, the retroreflective surface, and something and a magic wand. The magic wand is sort of like this trackable, a physical wand that can be used to manipulate objects that you see through the glasses, and the AR and VR clip-on. That's the important thing, because then it really is like you're getting three devices for one price.
$100 each.
Yeah. To my understanding, they were also at the Maker Faire in at least in the San Francisco area this year, and maybe a few other ones. But I've heard really positive things about it. The real question is, you know, we know that individuals are enthusiastic about it, as we've seen from other things. But now it's really making sure you get that corporate backing, you know.
Well, Kickstarter has once again allowed people to democratize their interest in a product instead of waiting for some angel to show up and do it. So, I mean, that's great. I think $300 for a device like this, it's on the cutting edge of technology. That's also pretty damn great. I mean, devices like this used to cost thousands of dollars.
Yep.
Absolutely. And this is like the real cost. Like, hey, if we get this, we can get this down to this cost if we get enough people.
See, I'm so confused about why Valve, you know, why Valve.
Because they had to, I mean, you have to think about it this way. If you're Valve and you're working on the Steam Box and you're working on next generation stuff, you're working with Sony, for instance, to make sure that the Sony PlayStation Network games can be also played on Valve. You're working with Rockstar to make sure that, you know, GTA 5 is going to be able to work on Steam eventually. You have to focus. You have to say no to certain things that are long shots, frankly. If you love something, let it go. And if it comes back into the marketplace in this case, you know it was meant to be.
Yeah, but let's look
the amount
at
of energy and time that they could spend chasing down VR technology, especially when Oculus Rift seems to be taking over the world in terms of VR.
Sure, but let's look at that example. I mean, anyone can see that this technology is very similar in potential to Oculus Rift, if not even triple the potential with the three different
Oculus
modes.
Oculus Rift has the backing. It's like GoPro and Contour.
Yes, but
Contour makes a wonderful helmet cam, but GoPro has all the public support and the might, and Contour folded because of that.
But at the time that this project was at Valve, even Oculus Rift didn't have quite the backing. And John Carmack was able to see the potential for this and bought into this. So it's like, I don't know why Gabe Newell didn't see the potential in what he had under his own roof.
Well, it's a question of focus. He's this could work really well, but I've got to make my Steam Box.
Yeah.
That's the future of Steam. I can't chase down these things and make my Steam Box. VR is a long shot, guys. Let's not remember. It's been 20 years. 20 years since VR was introduced in any kind of viable way, and it still hasn't taken off. It's taken 20 years for this technology to get to a place where we can get excited about it, and it still hasn't shown up. Google, they've got their glass, their augmented reality, so their AR stuff, and it hasn't lived up to the expectations that we talked about on this show already. It just hasn't.
Yeah.
This is, you know, and I'm not going to say I told you so, but VR, it's exciting because it's almost here. People want to get behind it, but it's still not here. And if you're trying to, like, you know, feed the people who work at your company and look toward the future, you have to make a choice. Yeah. And the Steam Box is the choice they made, I think. So I would say it's not super surprising to me that this was a project that was let go. What has surprised me and delights me is the fact that they let it go and they let it survive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what's amazing about it.
Yep.
Most companies say, well, kill it. Put it in a box.
Right.
Turn it into the Chevy, the GM EV1, where we dismantle everything and it gets all thrown away. But no. Why don't you guys want to do this? Fine, go do this. Yeah. We just can't pay for it.
I would love to see a happy ending to the story where they get funded, become a nice little startup. And then once Steam, gets a little bit bigger with the Steam Box, and has a little bit more of a war chest, that they turn around and buy the company back.
Right, or maybe they don't need to buy the company back. Maybe the company is its own open platform that's supported by the Steam Box first and foremost, but then get support by Sony, by Microsoft. You know, there's good news when these kinds of things remain independent because they can make integration happen with multiple devices, right?
Yeah.
Like, the iPhone integrates with multiple third-party devices. There's no reason why the VR headsets can't either. $289, huh, Andy?
$289, yeah. That's the price point that I just cannot afford at this point in my life.
289. I don't know.
Yeah, I always tend to convert things into chipwiches, and that's a lot of chipwiches.
Well, for my part, I look at this and I'm like, if it succeeds,
yeah,
then the second version is going to be very exciting.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
So I look at my Pebble. It's Kickstarter watch. I can't wait until the next Pebble shows up, with like a heart rate monitor in it,
yeah,
or something like that. You know, so well, I just feel like I'm interested in seeing this for $289. You're right. It is kind of steep. It's kind of steep. We'll see what happens for us. For the thing is, I look at, for instance, I spent $300 on the Piper, another Indiegogo.
Sure.
And the thing about the Piper is that it's standalone. It doesn't require any support from anybody else. I also got the Leap Motion. Leap Motion's really great,
mm-hmm.
but it requires application support from people like the New York Times and other guys who wanna show off this technology. And use software to allow you to get the most out of the technology. That's not so with this. Game makers have to sign on, early. Many of them, really, before this becomes something that begins to be worth that price point.
Right.
In addition, they need support from a console manufacturer and game developers before you can really get there. Yeah. And that's one of the things to think about when it comes to this kind of technology. I don't really think $300 is always too much for a Kickstarter Indiegogo project. Mm-hmm. But when the variables are sort of on the side, there are a lot of variables. A lot of people have to get involved in order to make this truly a success. And that means you have to get some hardware manufacturers to support it on their console, or it has to have like a Windows situation. And then you've got to get developers to support it visually. And they're trying to chase down all sorts of other things right now anyway. You know, like, when's Blizzard going to get behind this? When's Activision going to get behind this? EA, whatever.
You're right. You could end up with a $300 paperweight if nobody accepts this. Nobody adopts this particular iteration of this of the technology.
Right. 20 years VR. Yeah. 20 years The Lawnmower Man. How old is that?
Oh, man. Don't even mention the Lawnmower Man. What an embarrassment. okay, we're going to take one last break here, and when we come back, Apple gets to land its mothership and our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Well, all right, Star Child, citizens of the universe, recording angels, we have returned to claim the pyramid. Partying on the mothership, I am the mothership connection. Get down in 3D. Lightyear groove. Well, all right. You hear the noise? There ain't nobody but me and the boy. Get down. Hit it, fellas. Put a glide in your stride and a dip in your hip and come on to the mothership. Loose boot, doing the bump. Hustle on over here now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anofawakin. Apple's proposed new spaceship-shaped headquarters got a supercharged blast off this Tuesday when the Cupertino City Council voted unanimously to approve the 2.8 million square foot behemoth beside Interstate 280, fulfilling a dream of co-founder Steve Jobs's hatching an iconic landmark for Silicon Valley. This is like Steve Jobs' legacy. This was like one of the very last things that he personally publicly endorsed and pushed through. I remember seeing that video of him standing in front of the Cupertino City Council talking about this uh, this headquarters, and he looked about as bad as he had ever looked.
Badass.
What's that? But this is finally getting the launch off. The San Jose Mercury News has exclusive photographs of the models of the headquarters. It looks fantastic. Looks amazing. Looks really. It's got solar panels on the roof, an underground parking structure, and it's going to be camouflaged by thousands of new trees planted on the grounds. It's really exciting.
Why is it not in like the shape of an infinity loop?
I don't know. Isn't there a location one infinity loop?
Yeah, that's one Apple's headquarters.
Is one infinite loop Cupertino.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So why isn't this in an infinity loop?
That's a good question. But I guess
theoretically speaking, a circle is an infinite loop.
This is true.
Yes. I guess that's how they get around it. But it's got a pretty unique structure. Like currently, if you drive through Cupertino, and that's actually just literally right down the street from me,
mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of Apple buildings, but they're just kind of spread out. It doesn't feel like really most of Cupertino is actually kind of Apple, but it doesn't really feel as tightly compacted as it is, say, like Google.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of the things that Apple is completely running out of space as it is right now in terms of room to hire new developers and get them in. So I think this is going to be a big drive to kind of reclaim some of that space, have a very unique structure with underground parking and just be something that's really, really unique, I guess.
It reminds me of building the Umbrella Corporation would create.
I have to say that architecturally speaking, outside of the Pentagon building in Washington, D.C., I don't think I've ever seen a building quite like this one.
The Pentagon building is really ugly.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, at the time when the Pentagon building first was erected, it was kind of a landmark.
And also the size.
It's still a landmark.
Like, this
the
is
Pentagon
huge.
Is a phenomenal. Yeah, the Pentagon is phenomenally large, and it's got it's basically a symbol of the armed forces and the close.
Sure. And this, in a way, is his own symbol of to represent the corporate culture that it belongs to.
It looks like a ring as opposed to like a true UFO. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure.
Looks like the contraceptive ring kind of. So
or the one ring to rule them all?
I think
I was thinking more of the contraceptive ring.
Well, however you however you choose to look at it.
I don't know.
By the way, the announcement that they had been given the go-ahead was, I think, was Tim Cook's second official Twitter tweet. So, there you go. Okay, so let's talk about our drill-down video of the week. Are you guys are Game of Thrones fans, as
yeah,
am
definitely.
I. Dwayne, you're a fan of Song of Ice and Fire, the books that Game of Thrones are based on, but you have seen Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So this
I mean, it's well acted.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Stuff going on.
Yeah. Groundbreaking television. So this viral video of the week is from the good folks at Bad Lip Reading, who have made a cottage industry out of applying their own comedy lip syncs to existing material, transforming the work. And in this case, they basically take clips from season one of Game of Thrones, and they've cut together a faux trailer that basically looks like a trailer for a movie like Adventureland, which is the Greg Mottola film from a few years back about the kid who is coming of age working at an amusement park. But in this case, with the amusement park being like a Renaissance fair type of park, Game of Thrones themed Renaissance fair type of park. It's pretty funny. I recommend everyone check it out. We're going to have a link to it in the show notes. What did you guys think of this viral video?
Always clever how they pull these things off.
Yeah, I mean, the work and effort that it takes to do something of this nature is pretty astounding. And so it's always a technical marvel, especially with something as well acted as it is. It's kind of, it's pretty cool to see.
It's an editorial tour de force.
Yeah.
And that comes from an editor, so I would know. anyway, that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. I'm going to go around the table here, and starting with you, Dwayne, where can we find your work when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can always find me at Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. You can also find me on Facebook. I'm sorry, not Facebook, Google+, gplus.to/DwayneD. And then you can see everything I do at flavors.me/DwayneD.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find the rest of my ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me mostly at twitter.com and facebook.com at Mr. Baby Man. You can also find me online at Mr. Baby Man. Just do a Google search and you'll find all my social media links there. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.